Troy Green. ScoreOnAir.com. I am Matt Douglas. Along with me today again, Richard Rodewalt. Thanks for joining us for Cranes Weekly once again. With us on the line today from AltiWorld, a man who has been following the lawsuits and been writing and reporting on it since it started here July 3rd. Charlie Eisenhood is with us right now from AltiWorld.com. Charlie, thanks for being with us today.
It's nice to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Charlie, we'll just jump straight into this. You've been following reporting on the lawsuit for quite some time. You guys have posted not only the lawsuit, but some of the emails that you retrieved from a source. Are we all right to ask you who that source is and who's been able to help you out with some of the information?
Well, what I'll say is that there are various people in the league, particularly on the ownership side, who have an interest, I think, in sort of getting some of the story out there. And it's, I think it's not necessarily obvious who's getting up some of this information, but there's a good deal of it from a couple of owners. The particular source I don't think is that important, but I think that it goes to show sort of how the situation has unfolded, that people are willing to share internal communications so openly.
And then again, since you've been following this, I mean, you've gotten an idea of what the lawsuit, you guys actually posted the lawsuit on your website. For those of us who may not understand exactly all the law talk and all, can you help us a little bit better understand what the lawsuit exactly is the AUDL is proposing against the Rhode Island Rampage and the Connecticut Constitution?
Yeah, so it does get a little intense when you start to read closely into the law stuff. So basically, the league preemptively sued the teams and said two things. Their main contention is that the territory license agreement, the clause that says there's a 100-mile radius, is unenforceable because it doesn't hold up to Nebraska state law of being a reasonable clause, which essentially means that they're saying the teams don't need this much distance in order to have a properly functioning team. And there's a couple of other contentions in there as to why it doesn't matter, and you can look at those quickly in the lawsuit by just looking at the text of the lawsuit yourself. The other contention is that the teams knew about the New York and Boston franchises before they agreed to the territory license agreement, and then subsequently also after. The fact remains that it's pretty much nobody knows except for the league and the team owners whether that's true, because they both say one thing and the other side says something different. So it's going to be interesting to see if there's any way that they can actually pin that down in the courts. So we'll see what happens.
Charlie, Richard Rodewalt, and I have to ask you, I mean, obviously the lawsuit is something that isn't going to be, it's frowned upon, quite frankly. The AUDL already had some naysayers, if you will, about making this sport a professional sport and involving referees, and you hear a lot about spirit of the game. You hear from a lot of Ultimate fans, as we do here. What's your consensus on how they feel, I mean, now that we're going into the playoffs of the first season, how they feel about the AUDL?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it varies, but it seems to me that sort of the elite opinion that you're seeing online and sort of people who are particularly active in the Ultimate community online seem to think that there's real communication problems and that the league didn't properly reach out to the Ultimate community before sort of getting started. And that's why they're facing some of the problems they are now. So, the only owner who's played Ultimate before is Philadelphia's owner, Jeff Snyder. And that, I think, is a little surprising and off-putting to a lot of Ultimate players, because they feel like you can't just come in and just, start a professional sport without knowing anything about it. I don't know that that's true, personally, but clearly there's been some issues in terms of being on top of communication and sort of running the public relations side of things for the league. I mean, it's difficult to report when you can't get anybody from the league to talk to you ever. And that's
absolutely.
So have been trying to source facts without being able to talk to the league, and that's difficult.
And going back to, you know, this being the inaugural season and getting back into the lawsuit, it's not good when you're in your inaugural season and you're having legal battles already between the league and teams. With the $20,000 fines to Connecticut, have you been privy to any information on how they came up with that number? Because there's been, you know, obviously quoting your website, there's been a situation where Indy and Rhode Island now are sorting out what the fine will be there for them missing their game, but the league issued the fine, and that's via the emails that I read on altiworld.com. So how are they coming? To me, it's just like it's being done without any rhyme or reason, without any substance.
Well, right. So technically, in the league bylaws, there is a clause about fines. And it says, you know, if you're a minute late, for every minute that you're late to the game, you pay a $100 fine up to $10,000. So essentially, the league charged Connecticut the maximum fine for their two missed games during the time that they suspended their operations.
Okay.
So, you know, and it's sort of a legal standpoint, it's totally legal. But, yeah, I mean, to some extent, it is a little strange because it does seem like an excessive amount of money to charge when other teams have also forfeited games and haven't faced fines like that. And, you know, the sort of operating costs of the league are still high enough that sort of a $20,000 fine, you know, people aren't even making that much money in an individual game, right? So when people come and pay for their tickets, you know, they're not making even $10,000 in a game. So that seems like a sort of extreme fine. And, you know, I think it points to sort of how quickly this devolved from just a legal issue into sort of a contentious battle between particularly the Constitution and the league. I mean, I saw the on Twitter, actually, one of the Rhode Island Rampage players, Brandon Muffin Malachek, tweeted that Josh Moore came and hugged Emerson Kilgore, the owner of the Rampage, after their final game. So there seems to be a lot more, because, and remember that Rhode Island is also involved in the lawsuit, but there seems to be a lot more sort of friendliness between the Rampage and the league, who continue to have been included on emails and all these things, versus Connecticut and the league, who have really just, I mean, it's a very hostile relationship at this point. And that, honestly, no matter how the lawsuit turns out, I find it hard to see how Constitution come back next season to play after everything that's gone down.
You talk about the Rhode Island Rampage and their how they've been dealing with the league, a little bit fairer, a little bit more open to continue on playing. Do you have any answers for why they may be a little bit in better standing right now with the league than Connecticut, or have you been able to really get in touch with Rhode Island?
I've emailed Rhode Island, but I haven't heard back. What it seems to me is that they, despite sort of being involved in the lawsuit, they have continued to play, and they have not made statements to the press or big press releases on their website about the lawsuit. So it seems to me that the league really appreciates that. But I think, you know, on the other hand, Connecticut feels like they're very threatened by this lawsuit for obvious reasons. And that's why they took to the web in the first place, because remember, we all found out about this was by the Connecticut suspending their operations due to this lawsuit, which had been filed a couple weeks before. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out, but certainly we've gotten an unprecedented amount of insight into sort of internal league machinations because of this lawsuit, and, you know, we'll see whether they make it out in sort of with these eight teams. I doubt it. I mean, we already have to talk about what's going to happen with Columbus, but that's a whole other story.
Again, referring to the article you guys wrote on the lawsuit, is there anything in the lawsuit that says what would happen if the league were to win this lawsuit? I mean, what would they receive from Rhode Island and Connecticut? Does anyone actually know?
Well, it seems to me that if they win on their main contention, which is that the clause is unenforceable, They'll be able to put in Boston and New York teams, and presumably Rhode Island and Connecticut can continue to play. But, you know, that assumes a lot of things about how, you know, the fines that they get paid. Would Rhode Island and Connecticut want to continue operating? Rhode Island's already had a hard time getting fans to games, and, you know, sort of losing the Boston audience might be like a death blow. So I think, I don't know that the teams would have to actually give them anything, unless the court decided that they had to pay the court legal fees or something. They could pay the league legal fees. But basically the league would just be able to put in the new franchises.
Richard Rodewalt, Matt Douglas, ScoreOnAir.com, Cranes Weekly. Joining us on the line is Charlie Eisenhood of AltiWorld.com. And I want to refer back to some of the emails that you can find on your website, Charlie. I want to kind of switch gears now and talk a little bit about the playoffs, too. It seems there's a lot of uncertainty within the league. And you, obviously being in the media, you don't want to just be all speculation, but when nobody from the league will really take the time to give a statement or clarify things, and then you have emails where it seems like they're not even sure themselves about, should we go with a two-team playoff, a three-team playoff, where should it be played, who should be allowed in, what should we do with this and that and the other thing. The state of the league and going forward, it's got to be in grave danger.
Yeah, it is an interesting time. I mean, our most recent article on the AUDL situation talks about some other internal communications that we had. It showed that as early as like about a week from today, last Tuesday, the league considered allowing the Constitution into the playoffs. They were thinking about it, and they asked some owners about it in individual emails, and said, you know, what it might look bad if the Constitution aren't in the playoffs because they're one of the better teams in the league. But it seems that they decided against that, and then you saw the email chain that we posted full emails from. That showed that they were basically having a league vote on how to run the playoffs. And now it's a little more settled, but indeed it is interesting to see like how they're trying to manage the public relations internally isn't working because everything's getting leaked out to the press and they're refusing to talk, so it's hard to get a sense of where they stand on anything. It's been a tough few weeks for them, no question.
We are here in Columbus too, and you know, we might have been privy to a fantastic playoff race going down to the end of the season here in Columbus and within the Western Division that seemed to be decided by forfeits and games that weren't played. I mean, whether it was games right. against each other not played, or games Connecticut was supposed to participate in not played, or you know, the Indy and Rhode Island situation. And I know the consensus around here, especially from Cranes fans, is they got a raw deal. I mean, they have the best record when you take out the forfeits of games that were actually played. They have the best record within the Western Division, and they're going to be sitting at home. And you have, you know, the Bluegrass Revolution and Indianapolis Alley Cats going to play this weekend. Have you gotten any inkling as to why, you know, what's good for the goose isn't always good for the gander in the AUDL, so to speak, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, I think the Columbus situation is one of the more sort of confounding ones because, you know, it goes to show how little things can make a big difference in an upstart league, right? The issue of the heat, which was the main factor as to why those two games weren't played by the Cranes.
Right. Well, I mean, also why Indy and Rhode Island postponed as well.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it was really, really hot, and without sort of having the standard in the league bylaws that says you need to have an emergency medical person on the field, you know, you need to have cooling misters on the sidelines, right? These are things that would be great to have, but they're expensive, so, you know, they don't necessarily want to put that in the bylaws, but then you end up in a situation where at game time it's going to be really hot. And you're worried about your players, right? You know, it's kind of crazy to play midday like that in 100-plus degree weather.
Absolutely.
You don't have all of those safety issues. So, you know, okay, fine. How did that not get worked out with the league as to be something other than a forfeit? That is a mystery to me. And, you know, this is one thing where you can't, you know, we haven't been able to talk to the league, so how do we know?
Yeah, it's you can only speculate.
Understandably, yeah. And it, understandably for Cranes fans, it's very frustrating. You know, I think my guess is that the league would say, well, look, like, you can't just cancel games at your own whims. And other owners think that the game should have happened, right? That's the other thing that's important to remember, is that it was not all of the owners were on board with the game cancellation. And others thought, look, we ought to play the game and, you know, just have extra water or whatnot. I mean, I don't know the specifics, but there's differences in opinion among the owners, which I think sort of affects the way the league makes their decisions. So
you bring up the fact, Charlie, that there's difference between the owners. In your article, you wrote the internal AUDL emails show increasing dysfunction, legitimacy concerns. You kind of showed both approaches. Does it seem to you like right now the league's in a 50-50 split, or is it leaning one way more heavily? Are more teams backing the Constitution or more teams backing the league overall?
So, I mean, I haven't asked specifically about this recently, but from my understanding, it's about a 5-3 split in favor of the Constitution. You know, what does that exactly mean? It's unclear, but at least in terms of the legal situation, the majority of teams' owners are sort of falling behind Constitution and saying, look, this is, you know, they have a right to that territory. So, you know, on the record, we have Brian Ricci, the owner of the Constitution, obviously Emerson Kilgore, the owner of Rhode Island, Jeff Snyder, the owner of Philly, said that the league definitely should not have sued the team, and Tom Held, the owner of the Indy Alley Cats, also is on the record as saying the league is in the wrong. So that's four right there. But I believe there is one other team, and I just haven't been able to speak to all of the league owners in my writing so far.
Understandable. And there's a few new teams coming to the league. Expansion is what the league is trying to do in the upcoming seasons. Toronto's been one of the teams named. Jacksonville in 2014, Chicago, and Madison up there in Wisconsin. Have you heard anything from any of their owners about the possibility of maybe withdrawing from the league, or whether they're still looking forward to entering the league next season and the seasons to come?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've emailed a couple of prospective team owners but haven't heard back, but I have heard rumblings that there is some uncertainty and some sort of discomfort with what's happening right now. I haven't heard anything about wanting to back out at this point, but you have to imagine as we move forward over the summer, depending on what happens, that could be an issue. We'll see. I'm hoping to, and if any team owners are listening, please get in touch with me at editor@oldtworld.com. And I would like to talk, even if it's off the record, with them about what the situation looks like for somebody who's coming in next season.
All right, and Charlie, one last question before we let you go. This weekend, Rhode Island took off up to Boston and took on Ironside, a very elite club team up there in Boston. Ironside ended up winning this one pretty handily with a big victory. Do you think this does anything, especially from maybe a fan perspective? And again, I ask your opinion on this, but from a fan perspective, I mean, we're talking about maybe eliminating Boston as a team when their club team is beating AUDL teams that are going to make it to the playoffs.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the truth right now is that the AUDL doesn't have the best ultimate players in the country on their rosters. Some of them, yes, there are some of the best players playing, but it's not a sort of cross-section of the elite players. You're seeing a much more mixed bag. And Ironside is a team with a lot of history. They're very, very good, perennial Nationals team. They were second at Club Nationals last year. I don't think it's an embarrassment for the Rampage to lose to that team. You know, it's just that there are sort of two systems going on right now, and it's, you know, the AUDL is going to take some time to sort of recruit the top players. And I think the fact remains that the most prestigious ultimate tournament and sort of thing victory is winning the National Club Championships. And it may change over time. You know, we may end up seeing that the AUDL championship is the more prestigious title. But I think among Ultimate players, it's still club. It's club is still the sort of driving force for high-level Ultimate.
All right, Charlie, we appreciate you coming on the show today. If people want to get in contact with you, maybe find out a little bit more about what's going on, is there some place they can hit you up on Facebook or Twitter?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you can come to the website, opworld.com, and click the contact tab to get in touch with us personally, and follow us on Twitter at @ulti_world. Somebody is squatting the full Ulti World account, so @ulti_world, and we're on Facebook too.
All right, thanks so much, Charlie. We appreciate you having on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And no problem. We will be back with more to talk about here in our final segment. We'll go over the playoff race and a little bit more when we return to Cranes Weekly here on ScoreOnAir.com.